Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. It's Here and Now. Coming up, a former police chief on law enforcement soul-searching after the Ferguson shooting.
But first, the funeral. Thousands of people gathered today at the Friendly Temple Missionary Baptist Church in St. Louis to mourn the death of Michael Brown, the black teen killed by a white officer in Ferguson earlier this month. The family had asked for a day of silence. People obliged. But Brown's cousin, Ty Pruitt, vowed the protests will start again.
One day we're going to flood the streets with unity, and we're going to talk about freedom, and we're going to talk. And when they look out those windows, the colors that stand in the middle of the street going to be more beautiful than any rainbow they've ever seen. But not today.
President Obama sent three representatives to the services. Also at the church, WBUR's Deborah Becker from the Here and Now Contributors Network. And Deborah, obviously, we've been watching some coverage on television. Very difficult family, very difficult day for the family. But thousands there. What? Tell us what it looks like.
Oh, there are just thousands and thousands of people here. It's very emotional. I think it's been a little bit chaotic as all of these people crammed into this church. But this church here is huge, so it is able to accommodate quite a few people. It's got a big auditorium. It's got overflow rooms. But it's people from everywhere. You've got dignitaries. You've got all kinds of clergy and religious leaders, people from the neighborhood. So it's a real mix of folks here today. And, of course, they have been particularly roused by the speech from Reverend Al Sharpton.
Well, let's hear a little bit of the Reverend Al Sharpton, of course, longtime activist and also MSNBC commentator. Let's hear a little.
Michael Brown does not want to be remembered for a riot. He wants to be remembered as the one that made America deal with how we're going to police in the United States.
Deborah Becker, some of the other things that he said, what is the crowd reacting to?
Well, the crowd really reacted when he said, how do you think we look when young people who are asking to be heard and have concerns and they want us to hear their cry and we put snipers on a roof on them? How do we look to the world for something like that? And he said, you know, this is about justice. And he said, we are not anti-police. He said, but what we do want is a fair investigation, legislation, and ways to deal with this, because he says America has to deal with this policing issue. And that's what he says Michael Brown's death should represent.
Well, meanwhile, as you mentioned it, we know that there have been increasing numbers of people coming out in support of Officer Darren Wilson, who shot Michael Brown.
That's right. And actually, the Reverend Al Sharpton mentioned that today. And he said they certainly have a right to do that. They have a right. But he said, why is he asked this question and said, why is the world calling them supporters and saying that the folks who are supporting Michael Brown's family are dividing the country? And after he said that, everyone stood up in the overflow room where I am at the funeral, and applause just erupted.
We should say we have noted that ourselves today, that most media has been calling the crowds gathered in support of holding placards in support of Darren Wilson are called supporters, but those who felt they came out to support Michael Brown were called protesters. But, you know, we heard his cousin say that there will be more protests. What's the sense of what happens from here on out?
Well, I think that several of the speakers here today, Robin, really asked folks not to take to the streets again and not to continue the protests, and certainly not to get engaged in anything violent. And I will say that since I've been in Ferguson, it seemed to have calmed down. The crowds are fewer, and I think that it has calmed down, and there are a lot of conversations about what is the most constructive thing to do from here to try to affect change. If they believe that there really is a problem and it needs to be addressed, demonstrations are not the way to do it. I think folks agree with that. But it's so raw here that I wouldn't be surprised if people did take to the streets again.
WBUR's Deborah Becker in Ferguson, Missouri, and St. Louis. Deborah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The investigation into Michael Brown's death is ongoing. So is the debate over the actions taken by officials in the aftermath of Brown's killing. We wanted to get a police officer's point of view. Jim Bierman worked for the police department in Redlands, California for 33 years, including as its chief. He's now president of the Police Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan group that supports innovation and improvement in policing. And he's with us from the studios of KVCR in San Bernardino, California. Jim, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
And Jim, we have heard a lot of views about the Michael Brown shooting through from many different perspectives, but you're looking at this through the eyes of a police officer. What do you see and what do you think as you watch this situation unfolding?
Well, I have a lot of feelings and emotions about it. You know, overall, I think it's unquestionably a tragic situation for the community of Ferguson and all of the people involved. The young man lost his life. It has changed forever the life of the police officer that was involved. If there is any silver lining to such a tragedy is that it has sparked again the discussion that we should be having in this country about race, class, policing, the use of force, and how the police are perceived by the communities they serve.
And what do you think that the police force sort of collectively needs to be doing differently, should be doing differently, related to that conversation you think we should have?
You know, I think there are some universal principles that every police department ought to pay attention to. Sir Robert Peel, who is widely viewed as the father of modern policing, said that the people are the police and the police are the people. Means that the police department should reflect the community they serve in terms of its diversity. But it also means that there should be a co-production of public safety.
And when you say co-production, what do you mean by co-production?
So this is a fundamental underpinning of what's known as community-based policing. So do they consult with the community? Do they say, here is the crime problem we have. Here's a response to that that we think is going to be effective. What do you, the community, think about that? Because so much of what goes on in policing in terms of the community reaction is a direct result of whether the community has confidence in the police. Do they trust the police? Do they feel that they're open, transparent, and accountable? Do they feel they have a voice in terms of policing? And when the police department does not reflect the ethnic makeup of the community it serves, and that disparity is as significant as it is, or it has been reported in Ferguson, then in my opinion, the question is not, is there going to be a problem between the community and the police? The question is, when is that problem going to occur?
Jim, if you had been brought in as an advisor in the midst of the protests that were going on over the past few weeks, you know, a person killed, the community up in arms, the national media descending, what would your advice have been at that point?
The first thing for me would have been to make sure that everybody understood that there was a significant difference, it appeared to me, from the media reports between the protests during the day and the protests at night. The protests during the day appeared to me to be vocal but very peaceful. And the nighttime protests were entirely different, where people were throwing rocks and bricks and bottles at the police. So it had a very different personality. And during the daytime, the use of heavily armored up police officers carrying assault weapons, using armored vehicles, I think was extremely problematic as somebody who spent a lot of time in the world of policing. In a community-based policing organization, it broke my heart to watch police officers pointing assault rifles during the day at peaceful protesters. I think what they should have been doing is facilitating those protests and helping them.
Jim, on that issue of militarization, the former police commissioner for New York City, Ray Kelly, also weighed in on this. And he told ABC News over the weekend that people get uneasy when they see Humvees and military-type weapons on the street. Here's what else he had to say.
I think the fundamental question is, what is the need? Do we need that equipment? And does it make people feel like the police are an occupying army? So as far as the military distribution of equipment, I think it deserves examination.
Jim Bierman, do you agree with that assessment by Ray Kelly?
100%. I mean, he talks about people asking the question, what is the need? And I talked about the co-production of public safety. And I would suggest that you also have to have the co-production of public and policing policy. So that, for instance, if a police department wanted to acquire one of these heavily armored vehicles or other Humvees or whatever, the things that are very symbolic of this notion of militarization, does the locally elected body weigh in? Do they have a public hearing about this? Because it isn't so much the equipment, because those things have a rational use in policing depending on the situation. It is the context and the situation in which those pieces of equipment are used. I think if there was an armed robbery at a bank and the people doing the bank robbery were shooting at innocent people and the police, most folks would be okay with the police pulling up in an armored vehicle to try to safely apprehend those bad guys.
Among people who believe that something very wrong happened in the shooting of Michael Brown, and there are, of course, many people who feel that way, a couple details really stick out and come up over and over again. One is that he was unarmed when he was shot, apparently, and the other is that he was shot six times, according to an autopsy. When you hear those two things, what do you think?
Well, I think we don't know enough about the case to make a judgment. But remember, I'm looking at this through the lens of somebody who spent 3 decades in policing. So I understand the community outrage and the fact that people would be immediately upset about an unarmed person being shot, and there should be concern about that, absolutely, or the number of times he was struck by the officer's bullets, and they should be concerned about it. But there are technical issues involved in that that relate to stopping somebody who's assaulting you. I know several officers that have been severely beaten by unarmed suspects. So the fact that he did or did not have a gun in and of itself may not be as problematic as people think it is, but we don't know. The part of the problem with this incident is there's been very little transparency in the policing side of this story. People will naturally fill that void with their own perceptions, their own mental models of how the world works, that are informed by their experiences with the police. And if they have not been good, positive experiences with the police, then they're likely to fill that void with negative perspectives and conclusions and assumptions because nothing's countering that.
Jim Bierman worked for the Redlands, California Police Department for 33 years, including as its chief. He's now president of the nonprofit, nonpartisan Police Foundation. Jim, thanks very much.
It's my pleasure.
Syria's foreign minister is warning the U.S. not to conduct airstrikes against the Islamic State or ISIS inside Syria without the consent of the Syrian government. Now, there are those who say there has to be a response, punishment, for the beheading last week of American journalist James Foley by ISIS, which captured the journalist in Syria in 2012. Others are calling for a response before ISIS comes to the U.S., and the White House is considering the airstrikes. Military analyst Andrew Basevich is a professor of international relations and history at Boston University's Pardee School of Global Studies. He's also a retired Army colonel who served in Vietnam, and we always note his son was also military and was killed in the Iraq War in 2007. And Professor Basevich joins us once again in the studio. Welcome, as always.
Thank you very much.
And we've spoken before, and you know there are those who think that, you know, well, wouldn't you, of all people, want retaliation or punishment after the death of someone else's son, being James Foley, of course. You say what?
Well, I say that the anger and outrage caused by this horrible event are certainly understandable, but anger and outrage don't make an appropriate basis for policy. I mean, policymakers, particularly in matters related to the use of force, need to think coolly and need to think about, you know, what comes next after we avenge ourselves.
Yeah. Well, so the first call is for, as you say, avenging, revenge. The second call is for trying to stop ISIS because of this fear that it's really growing. Let's listen to something General Martin Dempsey, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said last week about ISIS.
This is an organization that has an apocalyptic end of days strategic vision, which will eventually have to be defeated.
So your thoughts there, that it has to be defeated?
Well, I think, I mean, General Dempsey is a very prudent man, and I think he accurately described ISIS's vision. But we have to take into account ISIS's capabilities. And there, the capabilities are real, but they are nonetheless limited. And when I say limited, I think we should exercise care in recognizing that ISIS does not pose a significant threat to the United States of America. ISIS does pose a threat to the people who live in the region. And certainly ISIS's actions contribute to the further instability of that region. We may note parenthetically an instability to which we ourselves contributed by invading Iraq back in 2003. So point number one is, it seems to me, don't exaggerate the threat as you think about what needs to be done to deal with the threat.
But there, devil's advocate, if it's a threat to stabilization in Iraq, isn't that a threat to the U.S.? We see, when a country devolves, first of all, you have more and more people joining the cause. Maybe those people come back here. Isn't general instability a threat to the U.S.?
I really don't think it poses a direct threat to your safety and to my threat. But the larger point you're making, I think, is a good one. We do have an interest in trying to restabilize the region. And the question becomes, to what degree, what actions on our part can in fact contribute to that outcome? And there I become a little bit cautious about the notion that somehow military intervention is the answer. Why am I cautious? Because we have been intervening in that region. Specifically, we've been engaged in a military intervention in Iraq that dates back to 1991, and it's difficult to see over the period of time since then that the country has gotten any more stable. So yes, we'd certainly like to see the Iraqi people get their act together. It's not clear to me that military action on the part of the United States contributes to that outcome.
Yeah. Well, staying with Iraq for a second, couldn't those who propose the U.S. policy, we're talking about U.S. policy, couldn't those who propose that the U.S. policy be more airstrikes in Syria? The success that the airstrikes seemed to have in Iraq. We remember that the U.S. was conducting those airstrikes against ISIS to try to help rescue the Yazidis who were trapped on a mountain. And it was said that those airstrikes were very successful.
Yes. I guess the position I take is this. In order to eliminate the threat that ISIS poses to regional stability, that will require an effective ground combat force. I would accept the notion that American air power can complement and reinforce the effectiveness of that ground force, but it doesn't seem to me that we ought to be the ones to provide the force. So the question becomes, who can we partner with? The Peshmerga, despite some recent setbacks, the Kurdish force, has a reputation for being relatively effective. Can the United States use its air power to further enhance Peshmerga's effectiveness, and that Peshmerga then becomes the force on the ground that can deal with ISIS? That seems to me to be a scenario that ought to be explored and could potentially yield a positive outcome.
Hmm. I think I know the answer to this next question, but I want to answer it anyway. You are saying that outrage over the murder of James Foley should not determine U.S. policy. Would you flip that? Because as we know, ISIS declared that James Foley was killed because of U.S. policy, because of the airstrikes. So should the U.S. not consider airstrikes because more Americans held hostage might be killed by ISIS?
No, I don't think so. I mean, in the same sense that our justifiable anger over Mr. Foley's murder shouldn't determine policy, the converse of that is the possibility that other individuals, brave journalists, could be abducted and murdered, that should not be a reason for us to refrain from doing actions that are actually prudent. The real question here is, what's prudent? What role the region is now in such turmoil? I mean, before I came in here, I read that we've now got Egyptian airstrikes in Libya. The region is in such enormous turmoil that it's very difficult to imagine what the United States can do to make a big difference. One thing we ought to do is not make things worse, and precipitate ill-considered military action, if we go by the record of the past quarter century, does tend to make things worse.
Yeah. Well, so just in the minute we have, you've said, don't have airstrikes, have U.S. policy. for retaliation. That's not a surprise from you. You've said that in the past. Consequences are more important than getting even. And it sounds like you're saying don't have the airstrikes with the thought in mind that they might wipe out ISIS. It's a much bigger problem than that. But do you think it's a good idea for any other reason to have airstrikes right now? Because this is what the U.S. is considering in Syria.
I think that if there is a force on the ground that we can partner with some expectations of that force on the ground being effective against ISIS, then that's a reasonable course of action. But I also caution you to say, even if through some miraculous effort on the part of Peshmerga, they destroyed ISIS tomorrow, let's not kid ourselves in somehow thinking that the larger crisis of the region is going to be resolved. That crisis is going to continue for a long, long time.
Andrew Bacevich, retired colonel, served in Vietnam, also professor of international relations and history at Boston University's new Pardee Center for Global Studies. Thanks, as always.
Thank you.
Burger King said yesterday that it's in talks to buy Tim Hortons, the Canadian coffee, donut, and sandwich chain. That sounds like a fairly routine business transaction. Two quick service food providers wanting to join forces. But this deal would be structured as a so-called tax inversion. That basically means Burger King's Miami headquarters would be moved to Canada to reduce the taxes the company pays in this country. To bring us up to date on tax inversions, Marilyn G. Wax is with us. She's a senior business editor at NPR in Washington. And Marilyn, what are the details of this possible business deal?
Hi, Sasha. You've got two companies here. They're both in the quick service food business. But Burger King was started in Miami about 60 years ago, and they are very much an American company, but they do business in about 100 countries. And Tim Hortons, it started 50 years ago. It's a Canadian company. We don't hear about it very much here, but there are really thousands of these locations all around Canada. So what they're talking about is putting these two companies together, and the headquarters would be in Canada. So that has the impact of allowing Burger King to lower its tax bill by considering itself a Canadian company. But you know, there are lots of reasons to do this deal, but it upsets a lot of people.
Right, exactly. And tax inversions have really been making headlines recently, usually in a controversial context. Can you go into some more detail about the advantages for companies when they do this and why Burger King and Tim Hortons want to do it?
Right. The law in this country is that if a company has 80% of its ownership based in the United States, then it's subject to U.S. taxes. So that's, you know, the tax rate here is really pretty high. Everyone in Washington would agree that the corporate tax rate is high, but we have a lot of loopholes. And the idea here is that Congress should reform the tax code and make it simpler, get rid of a lot of loopholes and lower that tax rate so that you don't have to go to other countries. But that's a very tough thing for Congress to do. You know, it takes a lot of hard work, and you may have noticed that hard work is not really Congress's thing these days. So they don't really want to roll up their sleeves and get into this, especially before a midterm election. So the whole issue in terms of the legislation is kind of on a back burner, and companies are going to do this kind of thing. Now, the emerging company, if it were to all go forward, if this really does happen, you shouldn't expect any huge changes at Burger King. You know, I'm not looking for maple syrup on my hamburger instead of ketchup or whatever. But you know, really, this is a situation where the mailing address would change, but very little else would change. This would continue to be a coffee chain in Canada and a hamburger chain in the United States. The thing that changes is the taxes.
And of course, from the standpoint of investors, cutting your tax bill would sound like a good move.
Yeah, it does sound like a good move, at least in the short term. But here's what critics say. Think about it long term. If Burger King and other corporations, others have been doing the same kind of thing, cut their tax bill, what happens to their customers? If you're a person buying a hamburger at Burger King, it's pretty likely you're not in the top 1%. You may be, sort of on the poor end of the scale. And if you have to pay more in taxes, that takes money out of your pocket. Or maybe you get fewer government benefits. They'd cut back on unemployment benefits or food stamps or Social Security. So there is an argument that in the long run, if you take money out of the pockets of consumers so that wealthy investors can have more, that creates an imbalance that drives down consumer demand. So there's a business argument either way. So a lot of people would like to have Congress or the president do something to stop this.
That's Marilyn G. Wax, a senior business editor at NPR. Marilyn, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
If there's one thing many parents of teenagers agree on, it's that their kids aren't getting enough sleep, at least during the school year. And studies show that lack of sleep often results in physical and mental health problems. Now, the American Academy of Pediatrics is recommending that schools delay their class start times for high schoolers and middle schoolers until at least 8:30 a.m. so students can sleep later. Judith Owens is director of sleep medicine at Children's National Medical Center, and she's the lead author of the Academy's policy statement titled School Start Times for Adolescents. Dr. Owens, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
And Dr. Owens, we've read that there actually is research showing that many adolescents and young adults suffer from lack of sleep. How much sleep does the average teenager need?
Well, somewhat to many parents' surprise, the average teenager needs somewhere between 8.5 and 9.5 hours of sleep per night. And the vast majority of them are not getting anywhere near that amount of sleep.
And what is it about teenagers biologically or physiologically that require that amount of sleep?
There's a very important change in biological change that occurs at around the time of puberty, which basically means that there is a shift in what's called our body's circadian rhythm, our biological clock, so that teenagers have a hard time falling asleep much before 11 p.m. And because they need that 8.5 to 9.5 hours of sleep, that means that they are biologically programmed to wake at around 8 a.m., a time when many of them are already halfway through their first period class.
So when kids are sort of snoozing in school, they're sort of nodding off, are you basically saying we need to be cutting them some slack?
Well, I wouldn't term it cutting them slack. I would term it giving them the opportunity to get the sleep that they need, because we know that there are very significant consequences to not doing that. And those range from effects on physical health, like an increased risk of obesity and type 2 diabetes, to safety concerns, an increased risk for drowsy driving accidents, and performance issues, so that students who don't sleep as much as they need get poorer grades, and they do less well on standardized tests.
I'm wondering if there may be parents out there thinking, or maybe even teachers, you know, they think the kids often are up till the wee hours of the morning doing homework. Should schools be doing something to cut back on homework for kids? Is that a solution? If they have less schoolwork, they may go to bed earlier.
Well, I think that's part of the solution. Also, another very important issue is the use of electronic media that many teenagers are indulging in the late evening hours. We know that watching TV, using computers, texting, all of those things are stimulating and tend to keep you up. And even the light from those computer and TV screens can suppress your body's production of the hormone melatonin, which is one of the most important signals to your body that it's time to go to sleep. So there are clearly additional measures that need to be taken and education that needs to be done. But what I would say is that at the end of the day, if school starts at 7:15 or 7:20, it's virtually impossible for teenagers to get enough sleep.
I want to note on electronic media that I imagine there are times when parents think their kids have gone to bed, but in fact you have a teenager up, you know, maybe under the covers with that cell phone texting. So despite a parent's best efforts, it might be backfiring.
Well, absolutely. And interestingly, in 2006, the National Sleep Foundation conducted a poll of sleep in adolescents. And even though 80% of adolescents were getting less than the amount of sleep they need, 71% of parents thought their teens were getting enough sleep. So there's a lot of misinformation out there, and part of our job is to provide education, and some of that education really should come through your primary care physician, your child's pediatrician.
If the school day were to start later for many high schoolers and middle schoolers, that would obviously have a big impact on schools and how they schedule classes. Did the Academy take that into account, or did it really just focus on teenage health?
Absolutely. I think that the Academy really takes very seriously the challenges that are involved in the decision that a school district makes to implement school start time delay. But what I would add is that there are at least, to our knowledge, 70 school districts across the country representing some 1,000 high schools which have already implemented this. And almost none have gone back. They've stayed at the later start times. So again, at the end of the day, this measure has such a compelling positive benefit influence on adolescents' health that it's really hard to argue that schools should not do this despite the challenges involved.
Dr. Owens, for teenagers who now have to be at school much earlier than 8:30, do you have any advice for them on what they could do to be more alert during the day or make up for lack of sleep?
Well, certainly sleeping in on weekends is not a good solution by and large because, first of all, it doesn't really help you be more alert during the school week, which is when you really need to be performing at your best. And that shift on weekends to a later bedtime and later wake time further disrupts your circadian rhythm and actually worsens the problem. So these kids are kind of in this semi-permanent state of jet lag, if you will. So what we would advise if, you know, teenagers really can't get an adequate amount of sleep during the night is to take a short restorative nap in the mid to late afternoon, meaning 15 to 30 minutes, just to recharge your batteries, kind of get yourself back on track, but not long enough so that it interferes with your ability to fall asleep that night.
Judith Owens is Director of Sleep Medicine at Children's National Medical Center, and she's the lead author of an American Academy of Pediatrics policy statement recommending that schools delay start times for high schoolers and middle schoolers until at least 8:30 a.m. Dr. Owens, thanks for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
And Robin and I are noticing that our listeners are already weighing in on this issue on our Facebook page. Heather Mapstone of Austin, Texas says her daughter's 9 a.m. high school start time is, quote, she says it's a beautiful thing. Here's what Heather writes. I can actually count on my kid getting up and getting ready and out the door on her own. I know this has upped her GPA as well.
9 a.m. Well, you have Fernando Mez and Chris Decker who still think it's the kids that you get to bed earlier to make waking up easier. But that is harder than ever
with
all the electronics. So tell us your thoughts. Should middle and high schools delay start times so kids can get more sleep? Go to facebook.com/hereandnowradio. Go to hereandnow.org. 9 a.m.
I wish I had that wake up time in high school.
Let us know your thoughts. We are radio, so we love sound, and the people who record and curate sounds, and we've been featuring them and what they've found. Here's an old printing press. Here's 225,000 cubic feet per second of water rushing over Niagara Falls. And then there's this. Bet you can't tell what this is. And that last sound, it's from an old oil field in Azerbaijan, and it was recorded by Peter Cusack, whose website is called Sounds from Dangerous Places. He joins us on the line from Berlin. And Peter, tell us more about that sound we just heard.
Well, it's from the oldest oil fields of the modern petroleum age, and it's next to the capital city, Baku, of Azerbaijan.
And why is it dangerous? I mean, you say the title of your website, Sounds from Dangerous Places, is not because the danger is to you, for instance, the short-term visitor, but to the people who have no option but living next to these sounds. So why is this sound dangerous?
It's a sound from a place which is one of the most polluted in the world. There are people forced to live there because they're excluded from anywhere else. It's geopolitically dangerous because the oil fields in that part of the world have been the cause of wars during their history and are still the cause of much political tension. So it would be hard to find a place where there are environmental questions which is more dangerous than that, I would think.
Let's hear a little more of the sound again from the oil fields of Azerbaijan.
The oil field is old, and a lot of the technology there is old as well, but many of the pumps are still working, and what you hear is the combined sound of all those pumps together. Each has a different squeak or hum, and that recording is when I'm walking around the oil field, so one pump gets louder and another gets quieter as I walk.
You also went to the Chernobyl exclusion zone in Ukraine. We've seen a lot of pictures from there of, you know, deserted schools, people had to leave certain areas.
The name exclusion zone implies there's nobody there, but I immediately discovered, of course, that that was not true. There are still up to 20,000 workers who go in there every day, and some in fact live there, to maintain the nuclear site and to continue the cleanup operation. And with that number of people around, of course, you need restaurants, bars. So there are still a lot of people there, but it's semi-militarized. You can't just walk in. You have to get permission.
Let's listen to a little of some sound that you gathered in Chernobyl.
That's a bar on a Friday night, which is a relatively empty night in Chernobyl because the workers who would otherwise be there go home outside the exclusion zone at weekends.
What's the importance of having the sound of a kind of low-key on a Friday night bar in the Chernobyl exclusion zone?
Chernobyl and most other disaster areas are extremely complicated places. And we get a very one-sided view of it. We hear about the radioactivity and the possible dangers of cancer and the fact that some of this radioactivity is spread all over the world, all of which is true. But it tells you nothing about what happens afterwards and who actually has to deal with the problems and what their lives are like.
Let's listen to a little more of your sound. We have two cuts here.
Душу село, моє рідне село, і хлібом, і цвітом, і прадідом, дідом.
Peter Cusack, what are we hearing?
Well, the footsteps are me walking around some of the abandoned buildings in Pripyat, which is still abandoned and still empty. The woman singing is one of the evacuees. Actually, that recording is 200 kilometers outside of Chernobyl in a village where she now lives. One of the big questions for all the people that were evacuated is how much they miss their home villages. And still, after 25 years, they all wish they could go back. And that song, although it's a fairly universal folk song, it's called My Beloved Village. And when she sang it, quite a lot of the other people in her current village gathered round and started crying because it reminded them so much of their real home villages and the pain of being forcibly evacuated completely against their will.
So sounds of grief, but also sounds of ongoing life. We have two cuts here. Let's just listen.
Yeah, those were both recorded in the exclusion zone. I made those recordings to show that actually the exclusion zone is now a wildlife haven. It's full of life, full of wildlife rather than human life. And it shows that nature can come back rather quickly if humans leave. It's a somewhat encouraging thing to find.
Well, you make the case that while pictures and words arguably do more explicitly than just sound itself, sound does something powerful.
Well, for example, that dawn chorus you just heard, I can say there's a fantastic dawn chorus in Chernobyl, and in words, that's how it comes out. If you actually hear a recording for a reasonable length of time, you can hear for yourself what the variety of species is and how intense it can be. Then compare that with the one that you might hear wherever you're living and see what it tells you about the state of wildlife in the place. And then remember that that's a nuclear site. And that raises an awful lot of questions about the environment, about the effect of nuclear accidents. All of those are big questions which we need answers and fuller information about. And I think sound provides it in this case.
The power of sound. Peter Cusack, a field recordist and sound artist based in Berlin, author of the book Sounds from Dangerous Places, website as well. The book comes with two audio CDs. Peter, thanks for talking to us about it.
My pleasure.
So, out there, if you record and curate sound, let us know at hereandnow.org, because, Sasha, I love hearing these sounds.
I know.
Let's hear a little bit more from Chernobyl, from Peter's recordings. Sasha, do you know what this is? Again, it's at Chernobyl.
Can't tell if it's animals or electronics.
Oh, you know, you're so on it, because it's both.
Really?
Give the listeners another second. Well, it's Chernobyl. So you may be guessing that that's a radiometer.
It's monitoring radioactivity.
Radiation,
at the
yeah, in the Chernobyl exclusion zone. But that behind it is a cuckoo bird.
Oh, really?
Hear it in the background?
Oh, yeah.
So it's the juxtaposition that's so striking.
Oh, yeah.
Measuring for radiation, and yet that bird has survived.
Still there, the wilderness going on.
Again, let us know. Do you collect sound? We'd love to hear it. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Here and Now.